Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. So thank you very much, Elizabeth, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
I'm delighted to be with you, Fergal, here in Honolulu. Over to you in London.
Yes. Well, you're an evolution biologist and a futurist, and you've been doing this for some time. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you do?
Yes, I from childhood wanted to know who this strange humanity is and where we came from, where we're headed. So I wanted to study science, thinking that was the way to find out. But my parents drove me to art school on the grounds that back then in the 1950s, girls were not doing science. And I did eventually become a scientist, and I did my best work after my postdoc and a job or two in a research institution, when I moved to Greece and could think freely on Greek islands about how this earth of ours works and what we strange species calling ourselves Homo sapiens, as if we were wise, are all about.
What is an evolution biologist?
Well, an evolution biologist looks at the trajectory of what I would consider the living Earth. Western science doesn't quite get that yet, although your Brit, Jim Lovelock and Lynn Margulis in the United States, he, an atmospheric scientist, geomicrobiologist, worked out this Gaia hypothesis, this Gaia theory of the living Earth.
Now, maybe it's a good place to start, because I know you James Lovelock wrote an introduction to one of your books, and you're working in a very similar area. What is it about Gaia that you think is helpful in terms of understanding the environmental crises that we're facing, or more importantly, how we deal with them?
Yes, I think it's very, very important not to see our planet as a chunk of geology that somehow magically produced life on its surface, but to rather see it the way most of humanity has seen it, as the Mother Earth. And I'm not trying to promote the idea of a big mama so much as of a living entity. Probably the best description of it I ever saw was kind of like a giant cell. And I love that, because cells are the basic unit of life of Earth, and they keep being important as we go along. We are made of cells. Our cells are made of smaller cells. It's a fractal kind of situation. So it makes sense that the whole planet should be a kind of living cell, with the life on the sort of tangible life on the outside, the way it is on a redwood tree, which is 99% dead matter with a living bark on it and leaves or needles, as the case may be. So there are lots of parallels with living organisms that work very well for the Earth. And when you get that, you see how the Earth has to keep taking care of itself as best it can, the way every living thing does. It tries to stay alive. So sometimes she gets fevers and has a hot age, and sometimes she gets chills and she has a cold age. It is a living entity, and when we get that we are part of a living entity, like another set of bacteria crawling around on her surface or whatever metaphor you want to use for us, then I think we develop a very different relationship with it than if we see it more in the Western science way, where ecology is really about seeing Earth as a set of resources for human consumption. And of course, we've got brilliantly mad with that idea, and are now in bad trouble because we've wrecked it to the extent that it has to save itself by bringing on another hot age. And humans survived 10 or 12 ice ages, we've never faced a hot age before.
You covered a lot of ground there. To what extent, this idea of Gaia and this idea of this kind of like self-regulating system, this living kind of system, this living being, how would that have changed things? I mean, to what extent have we embraced that idea in the past or not embraced it? What is the opposite of that? And to what extent do you think that that is at the root of some of the problems we face today?
Well, many indigenous cultures, of course, saw the earth as alive, if not all of them. I don't think that the idea of non-life ever came into the world until Western science produced that idea that non-life can come to life. Once you adopt the hypothesis of a living universe, you don't have to explain where life came from because life is simply the self-organizing process of a living universe. So you get rid of one very big problem of how to get life out of non-life. I happen to think that if mud were really dumb, lifeless mud, it would never bootstrap itself into life. So it makes more sense to me as an evolution biology to adopt that idea of the living universe, which, of course, contains living systems of all kinds, including the planets that revolve around some stars.
Yes, yes.
Now, as I said, indigenous cultures got that everything is alive, but Western science killed that whole notion.
And what happened as a result of that? Why was that a problem?
Just what I said, because we applied the ideas of the earth as resources for humans, which started with certain interpretations of the Bible saying man has dominion. And nowadays, the more progressive Christians say, and Jews, because they both have the Old Testament, they take that dominion to be the responsibility of care rather than the lording over and exploiting of. So I look to indigenous cultures who built their human societies on the basis of a living earth. And my favorite, of course, is the Haudenosaunee, which the Europeans called the Iroquois, from whom the United States got the basis of its constitution.
What do you mean?
That's a very interesting story. Benjamin Franklin, one of our founding fathers, spent a lot of time with the Haudenosaunee Indians learning their great law of peace. And their great law of peace gave us our balance of powers, the divisions in the government, and the whole concept of how a democracy is a rule of the people, by the people, for the people. Unfortunately, the founding fathers left out of our constitution, based on that Iroquois great law of peace, the role of women, children, and nature. And they're the ones who got famous in retrospect for thinking seven generations ahead, when our psychologists are still trying to say that we're a short-sighted species who can't do that. They did. Every deliberation they made had to be thought in terms of how it will affect seven generations down the road, just what the Greta Thunberg youth are now demanding, that they have a right to a future.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Now, you've been working in this as an evolution biologist for some time, some decades. What's on your mind at the moment, and what keeps you awake at night? You have seen the the trajectory and the peaks and troughs in terms of awareness when it comes to environmental issues. And what we can do, and there's tremendous momentum in certain areas today, as you mentioned, Greta Thunberg, and there's Extinction Rebellion. There's some movement there, shall we say? At the same time, we're running out of time for some of these environmental crises. Where do you think we are today?
Well, you know, it's interesting. More than half a century ago, I was doing a postdoc at the American Museum of Natural History, where we were already talking about climate change. And then in the 80s, sitting around with Jim Lovelock, who came to visit me in on my Greek island, where at that time I was working out evolution biology from my own perspective, trying to get beyond Darwinism. And he was saying, pray, Elizabeth, that we go into another ice age, because we're due for one now, because it looks like we may be tipping into a hot age instead, and that's going to be much more difficult for us. In both cases, I'm very aware that the temperatures only change by something like 7 or 8 degrees, I think, centigrade, off what we consider normal. We've been living in a very benign age for humans now since the last ice age. But we got through the last ice age and a dozen before that. And what's on my mind a lot now is, look, people, this is bloody serious. And it's not being taken nearly seriously enough. Just in the past year, I would say there's been a huge leap in awareness. But it's already, you know, we're already at the tipping point. Anyone who understands anything about the hockey stick exponential curve knows that if a pond is being covered by pond lilies that reproduce one a day, each leaf giving rise to two, that 2 days before the end, the pond's only half full. And one day before the end, it's only three quarters full. You can do this with a jar of flies or anything else. It's the most important piece of math you should ever learn, is how fast things go in an exponential curve once you round that bend where suddenly the doublings show up seriously. And that's are there. We're facing very serious sea level risk. 13 of our 20 largest cities are at sea level, which is where they build their airports and piers, meaning everything coming in and out of that city by air, land, or sea is in trouble, right? Only by land might you still have some hope, but that's the very slow way compared to airplanes and nowadays yes. Ships.
Yes. Gaia, I guess underlying this is an idea that there's a kind of single, I guess, what you call self-regulating system.
Yes.
And I guess homeostasis is a part of that. And
it's homeostasis, really. The set point can change. The climate average is a kind of set point, like on a thermostat, which is self-regulating the heat in your room, right?
Yeah. No, and I'm interested in trying to understand this because I guess – some interpretations of the Gaia ideas talk about or have a sense that things will come back into balance, that, you know, there's a homeostasis, that things will come back to the median or the middle again, and, you know, we'd have some extremes. Is that right? Because that would suggest that you know, there's a reasonably optimistic scenario.
Yes, in a sense, it is right. Over the 4 billion years of Earth's life, it has maintained a relatively stable temperature. Within those 4 billion years, you shift from that kind of homeostasis to a homeoresis, where the Earth has to reset its climate occasionally in order to overall maintain that homeostasis. You're right.
So what does that tell us about this question? I know that we this question of these different Earth systems and this, and tipping points, which are, I guess, like a lot of things in systems theory, quite difficult to pin down. We know that they exist. We know that how they're going to, potentially the kind of magnitude of change, but we're not quite sure when they're going to happen and so forth. How does that impact?
Well, we have been wrecking the Earth's ecosystems to the point where it's giving her a fever now. She has to readjust to a hotter climate to make up for the damage we've done. You know, we're killing off the oceans. That's probably the greatest danger, is our killing off of the oceans, because land life will not survive well if the oceans go. And of course, the Earth has been knocked back to something like 95 to 98% of its life extinguished and still recovers. So she can go all the way back to bacterial life and do it all over again for another couple billion years, and until the Earth's life is naturally over within the galactic spans of life. So for us humans, tipping points mean when we behave so badly that we've suddenly caused damage we can't reverse anymore. And as far as I can see, we're beyond the tipping point on climate change in the sense that we can no longer reverse it. We can't bring it back to where we were, but we then have to adapt. And adaptability is a human trait. We can do it. I visited Morocco years ago just to see how the Moroccans adapted to life in a desert, you know, which is definitely 8 degrees hotter than what most of us live at, you know, comfortably. And they did it. They were able to do it with very low-tech solutions. So I know that we can adapt, but I doubt seriously that all of us will get through this. We'll be in lower numbers by the time this perfect storm of crises has been sailed through.
Now, you've seen this, I guess, as I said, that, you know, the rising, that, you know, there have been moments before where there's been a growing environmental consciousness and a growing sense of what's happening. Certainly today, in the last, you know, as you say, 6 months, year, there's been considerable momentum on a couple of fronts. But the question about how to deal with the situation we're in, and, you know, who's responsible, and you know, they're gnarly questions, because of course we're all responsible. Every time we go shopping, we buy it with our plastic bags and we get into the car, and yet we're part of an industrial civilization, you could say, which has you know, tremendous power and momentum.
Absolutely. And you know, we know that whole industries can get retooled almost under overnight, you know, as Roosevelt did in the United States when we were getting into World War II. Suddenly the whole economy was retooled and we were building war equipment and women were suddenly in factories, and all of that kind of thing can be done. We can ban plastics, the further production of plastics, but we're going to have to get very busy recycling the plastic we do have, fishing it back out of the ocean, and putting it to the uses that are most important to us. We can also go back to more eco-friendly equivalents to plastic, such as celluloid was, and the Japanese are starting to do that. We can do what we call biomimicry these days, and copy nature, which makes the strongest and most durable and most beautiful materials on the planet. You know, spider silk and mother of pearl and all these amazing things that can be made and be biodegradable.
Yes, yes. Now, what do you think are the parallels between, we talked earlier about cells and this idea that, about cells and human society. Are there lessons for us? Because it's always tricky, it seems to me, and I'm not a scientist, when one enters the realm of science, talking about science, whether one's, you know, should we say, pushing the metaphor a little bit far, whether one's actually just being metaphorical rather than actually discussing, understanding forces that are really in play.
Well, I'm laughing a bit because, of course, you cannot do science without having some concept of what science studies. Right? In other words, if you want to build a science that studies the universe, you have to have some notion, what is a universe? Or you can't even make a theory. So science rests on a set of very fundamental statements dignified with the name axioms or fundamental assumptions. They are assumptions about what this universe is. So Western science, for instance, assumes this is a non-living universe. That's no more provable than my saying it's a living universe. How do you prove this is a non-living universe? It's impossible. And you're not expected to. Assumptions are considered unprovable statements. So you decree this is a non-living universe. It is made of matter and energy. You can study it objectively without interfering in it. You can study what it is as if you can get outside of it and look at it. And this thing that we study it with, which is primarily, of course, the human mind, has somehow come into being through a long series of accidents we call evolution, which produced something we named consciousness way, you know, close to where we come onto the scene. Now, those are the basic notions of a universe that Western science is built on. There are other sciences in the world built on very different assumptions. There's Vedic science that's been around for thousands of years. There's Taoist science out of China. There's Islamic science, a lot of which got worked into Western science. Every indigenous culture I've run into does scientific experiments and studies nature scientifically. So there are many ways to look at nature. And when you say, well, Western science has proved something and you're just using nice poetic metaphors, I say, excuse me, but why do you say that? And then the scientist will say, because you can't prove it. And when I ask him, how do you prove what you believe, I can pin him to the wall.
Now, it's very interesting you say that, because at the same time, these metaphors are powerful in the sense that, having a scientific basis, should we say, the machine metaphor of the universe and so forth.
Exactly. You can't do any science without metaphor.
Right. So so this is quite an interesting question because, we all act in the world, without having, although we pretend to be rational and so forth, but not necessarily having conscious scientific models in which we operate. But there's the Newtonian whatever machine model. Then there's the kind of quantum scientific model, physics model. And I'm wondering, because Gaia is clearly not so much in terms of physics, it's more of a biological metaphor, I guess. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of these metaphors? Because, on the one hand, as you say, you can't prove them or not, but in a certain sense, there's a self there. But at the same time, they are important because the degree to which they spread and they become dominant and they reflexivity the world and therefore behave within the world is at the same time relevant, I guess.
Absolutely. And Fergal, it's not just that it's critically important to understand that the metaphors determine your whole belief and your whole action, and that science cannot explore the unknown except in terms of the known. So we've used metaphors, from. Starting with the atom, let's say at solar system, and the brain became a set of telephone networks, or first a plumbing system. Freud's jamming up the pipes, kind of valves and pipe system, and then we invented the telephone. The brain became a telephone network, and then we invented the computer, and it became a computer. And then we got parallel processing going, so now the brain's a parallel processor, a hologram. Whatever our technology, the latest one is, the brain hasn't changed, but our metaphors have. And so our whole view of how it functions has. So the way we see the world depends on our metaphors for the planet. And biological, yes. Consider that if... instead of Galileo having looked up at a telescope into the sky, he had turned those lenses around and built a microscope and looked at a drop of pond water, he might have decided that everything in nature was alive and maybe the whole universe was alive, rather than, you know, taking up the old medieval models of planets revolving around the Earth and stuff and making it into a mechanical universe. Because, of course, machinery was what they were enamored of, the founding fathers of Western science. And so they saw everything as machinery. And that was a very heady idea because they were, in fact, the inventors of machines and knew exactly how to control machinery, whereas nature up until then had been seen as dark, mysterious, feminine, and you'll never be able to understand her. So best to turn her into a machine that you can not only understand, but control.
Well, that's very interesting, because if we're coming back to Gaia, because Gaia, it's not an essential part of the metaphor, but, you know, that Gaia is female. It's just, but Gaia, can you talk a little bit about how useful, how has Gaia, you know, it's had some momentum. There has been, I guess it's moved from what they call a kind of hypothesis to a theory, or I'm not quite sure when that happens. But it's not something you necessarily hear people talk about a lot at the moment. Can you talk a little bit about where you see, I mean, this is quite a esoteric, I guess, Elizabeth, but where we are with our metaphors and how useful the way we see things are now in terms of really, you know, not just analyzing the roots of the problems, but that's part of it, but actually dealing with the crises we're facing?
Yeah, well, it's absolutely essential that we get how the self-regulating systems of the planet work, whether you actually adopt the idea of calling it Gaia or not, get that that these ecosystems do take care of themselves when people don't mess around in them.
So that's tipping points. The key. So talking about tipping points is a way of getting to this point.
Yes. And that's why I think the exponential curve is so important to understand, because people would like to think that, okay, if the sea's going to rise, it'll go up a millimeter at a time, a centimeter at a time. It's way off in the distance. It's not for me to really worry about, instead of recognizing that it can also rise by the meter at once. And that's what we're not getting. When you look at the ice melt in the Arctic, for years now, the atmosphere has been carrying more than 40% moisture above its normal carrying capacity for moisture. What happens? The wind belts around the poles where all this stuff is evaporating, as we know, we can see it in satellite images, how much of it has gone from the edges. We can't see from the satellite image how much shallower the ice is yet, but we see the waterfalls pouring down into sinkholes in the middle of the ice, and we see the glaciers calving off the end, and those wind belts dropping down closer to the equator so that we're getting massive flooding all over the middle of the United States now, where we have never had that much flood. At the same time, we've got these tornadoes whipping up because these wind belts are not where they used to be. They've changed position, and they're dropping their snow and ice in places where it hasn't been before, which makes all the Midwestern Christian fundamentalists say, see, it's obvious there's no global warming. Look at all this hail coming down.
Right? Yes, we need a bit more. We need a bit more global warming, as Donald Trump would say.
If we understood the systems, then we could predict much better the difference between weather and climate. Is like the difference between the planet's age and our age. You know, it's we have to think in terms of these big systems, and it's coming on fairly suddenly. What we do get is that if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to keep getting what we're getting. And if we keep clogging the oceans more and more, there will be fewer and fewer fish and living things in it. But what we still don't seem to want to grok is how fast it goes after that tipping point.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting because I guess a tipping point is a slightly less technical way of talking about nonlinear change. And nonlinear change is, it's not something that's necessarily quite easy to get the message across about. And but that's what we're talking about. We're talking about fundamentally, and I guess that is to do with the question of how good we are at scientific communication and talking about, science, how good scientists and not just scientists, but how good we are sharing scientific knowledge and talking about, and really, really getting the message across about nonlinear change.
Yeah, well, in addition to that, we have the problem that science has all been politicized. So science is supposed to be politically neutral. Of course, it's always been done in the context of all of human behavior. And the reason that we've wrecked things so quickly now in the past couple hundred years since we discovered fossil fuels is because because science was taken over by the young industrialists in England who had the church and state had been the rule, right? Church and state were the alliance. And then we shifted into an alliance between industrialism and science because the church threw science out and the industrialists got the value of science. So science has been politicized from the beginning in the sense that industry started ruling politics. So we have now a world in which we are in the third phase of what I call evolutionary empire building. And to explain that, I have to say that evolution proceeds in a maturation curve from a youthful Darwinian competitive phase to a mature Kropotkinian, I say, because the Soviet Union taught cooperation in nature through Kropotkin's work, who had built on Darwin to see that there's a mature phase where things cooperate. And it happens when it gets too expensive to continue to compete, when a bacterium or a single cell or a multi-celled creature, even a human, gets it that it's more energy expensive to kill enemies than to feed them. Capitalism doesn't allow you to feed your enemies because you're in a competitive empire building mode. The first empires were built about 6,000 years ago with empires ruling them. Then we moved into corporate empires like the British Empire, the Dutch Empire, the French. There were 8 of them. The first multinational was the East India Company, which had a British, a French, a Dutch, a Portuguese component, right? The first multinational was the East India Company, which led to the exploitation of the Americas.
You say something interesting there that you talk about, and I know you're talking about at a cellular level biological level, that thing being too expensive to compete. But I suppose if you translate that into the our world, it assumes possibly rational behavior.
Well, I'm saying that now we're at the last empire phase is the corporate empire phase. Corporations are now more powerful than governments.
Why is that the last?
Because it can't go any further because we're killing it off. Because we're going to grow up, Fergal. Those people who survive this perfect storm of crisis this time, which is planet-wide, are either going to get it that you have to fit the economy into ecology, which gives you the wise society, the ecosophy, instead of making ecology subservient to your economy, eating up nature to drive consumerism, production and consumption.
Now, that's very interesting, and it brings to exactly this the point, which I would really be interested. Can you talk a little about it? And also linked to that, and I know this is linked, is this question, and you talked about this at the beginning, about the indigenous peoples. And I'm just wondering what in your ecosophy, the indigenous elders have to teach us. And I'm mindful of the distinctions you made between different kinds of sciences in yes. a sense, or different sciences, that there might be different kinds, but different sciences earlier in the discussion.
Yes, every indigenous culture I've come in contact with myself personally has produced a pretty wise society. Some of them were what I would call patriarchal socialism, as in the Inca Empire. And it's interesting that China is now repeating that model of patriarchal socialism as it expands around the globe, doing exactly what the Inca Empire did, which was making everybody promises they couldn't refuse so that they came into the empire without being fought. You see, China's got it, that it's better to feed your enemies than to kill them. And that's what it's doing. It's basically, it's buying them off. It's feeding them. It's developing them with its patriarchal ownership oversight kind of in place. And that's as far as it can go now on the planet. And as I say, those humans who survive these crises now will be the ones who get how to take care of themselves without violating the principles of nature, such as recycling. So I look to the wisdom of indigenous cultures because they already built these wise societies like the Iroquois started out talking about. And that, calling it ecosophy, which I did not coin that term, but I adopted it. The word ecos is the Greek word for household. It is a holarchic term, an embedded term. It applies to a family household, a social household, the cosmic household. All of it is an ecos. It's a cosmos, our people, at all those levels. The ancient Greeks thought in terms of these levels from cells up to the universe, right? And that's what we're learning to do now ourselves. So when we adopted the Greek words ecology and economy, ecology is ecos and logos, which is the design of the household. Economy is ecos with nomos, law, the rule of the household. We separated those and then, as I said, made the ecology, the household, whole design of the household, we took over in our economy. And if we turn that around and design an economy that fits into nature without harming it so that it can continue to self-regulate and take care of itself, then we have the wise society, the ecos with Sophia, Sophos, wisdom, the wise household. Does
now,
that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. And are you optimistic that there were some momentum, that the roots for this? You mentioned the Chinese, the Belt and Road Initiative. I mean, as I understand it, there's very different policies and approaches to many questions, including environmental questions, within China and without China, outside of China. And the Belt and Road Initiative seems, from people I've spoken to on the podcast, to be quite an aggressive and unregulated attack on the environment, through development of infrastructure and so forth. So I just wonder, when you mentioned the Chinese, whether you were giving them some accolades there or not.
Well, it's ironic because within China, they're getting pollution has to stop and they're closing down coal mines.
Yes.
And yet they're building new coal mines along the Belt Road.
Well, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
Because it's the fastest way to industrialize these countries, they believe. I don't know why they haven't gotten it yet, that you could solar energize and wind energize. India's doing a lot in that direction of clean green energy. I don't know why China isn't doing much more clean green energy down that Belt Road. It dismays me that it isn't. As I say, I think it's the last wave of empire. It's patriarchal socialism. Its own people, I think, have risen up enough already to get a lot of green energy going within China. And they're selling solar panels to the world. And, at the same time, we've now got a war between, can China or the U.S. cover the earth in 5G fastest, which is one more suicide weapon humanity has thought up for itself. But I do think enough people are getting it, and they're getting it mostly through local self-building communities, communities like Findhorn in Scotland and Pondicherry in India and Dominur in northern Italy, where people practice permaculture and try to get food and energy self-sufficient. Those are the pockets that will last. If they're on high enough ground and they're creating their own energy and food, they will survive.
That's a very interesting point that you make. I'd like to come back to the ecosophy and get a sense of a bit more of where you think we've, you know, what are the move, where's the movement there? What are the trends? What's you know, make you optimistic mm-hmm. there? But you talked about this, you know, so some people I've spoken to on the podcast laterally, a couple of people have had a pretty negative perspective on where we are, and one or two have talked about really saying that this is a giant machine, industrial civilization, that's you know, vast, complex, and has tremendous momentum, and you know, we can't stop it, it's going where it's going. And they talk about creating pockets, I suppose you'd call it, of resilience. And focusing on, you know, whether it's community level or even city level, you know, I guess, you know, communities that are holistic and resilient in the face of a collapse of what you might call industrial civilizations, so the supply chains we're so reliant on, and so forth. Is that a perspective that you take?
Absolutely. And it goes way beyond those few intentional communities I mentioned. Some of the larger experiments are the island nation of Sri Lanka, where there's a big movement there that's based on self-development in small villages. In other words, it's linking 10,000 villages together in a rural economy. In Spain, Mondragon is a set of urban cooperatives that are worker-owned and where they made the decision that no salary should be more than 8 times the lowest salary. And everybody's happy with that. And the workers become owners over time of their own businesses, and they produce industrial equipment and buses and you know, quite large things, and have in part their own banking system, so they survived the 2008 crash better than most of the rest of Europe and the United States. And then we have, like you've had Hazel Henderson on a podcast, and she shows how there are now, what, $13 trillion in green investments. My friend Rinaldo Brutico, head of the World Business Academy, is working with Deepak Chopra, a spiritual leader. I call him a Vedic scientist. And they're on Wall Street doing just capital. They're getting even companies like Goldman Sachs wanting to join them, paying to join them, rather than laughing in their faces.
And do you really believe that Goldman Sachs, do you really believe Goldman Sachs has got these values that really...
No, they're just seeing that there's money to be made in green investment, that's all. They're still the giant squid.
Yes, but, yes. No,
you're right that humans maybe can't stop this capitalist machine in its tracks, but when the New York Times has front page articles saying, questioning capitalism, it's on the table at least that we can question what we're doing. And for, you know, all during the Cold War, we couldn't say the word community because it made us a communist. So there is a lot of change going on in the world. However, the climate change is the biggest change that we're undergoing. It's bigger than us, and it's what will stop the machine.
Are you optimistic?
I'm optimistic that climate change will stop the machine, and I'm optimistic that a fraction of humanity will get through, and that everybody has the right and obligation to believe that they and their families could be among the survivors, so get working on it.
I find that hard to really classify as optimistic. How do you think this is going to play out?
I'm optimistic that humanity will not get wiped out.
That's rather different from saying that, you know, we've got a hiccup and, you know, we will, you know, manage.
It's not a hiccup. It's a serious disease.
Yes. Well, so what is your advice then? What is your sense? You know, you understand and this cellular approach, which operates at different levels.
Yes. What I urge people to do is to really try to grok the situation, to understand how serious it is, and then to find there are a gazillion ways that you can work on a better human future. As Rumi said, there are 1,000 ways to kneel and kiss the earth. And Rumi also said, why do you stay in prison when the door is so wide open? We humans have created the system we're living in now. We are eminently capable of designing a whole, what my group that I'm working with right now is called Tomorrow Makers. You can see the website at tomorrowmakers.org. We are trying to design games to try out new human operating systems without risk, and asking the deepest possible questions. Do we want land ownership by humans to continue into the future? Is that a sensible thing to do? Or can we do land leasing the way China already does? Do we want to take a money system that was designed to concentrate wealth and about which we were warned by all the major religions 2,000 years ago that has now played itself out in the greatest wealth gap ever known? Do we want to carry that into the future when our own bodies give out free money in every cell? You don't have to do debt money in order to have money in your system. There are so many ways to do it, and what every person should do is take what you're most passionately love doing, whether it's writing poetry, nursing people, going to political demonstrations, cleaning oceans, building new devices, designing houses, whatever it is, do what you most love doing in a way that's sustainable, that serves society, that meets people's needs without destroying nature, or that's cleaning up nature. Promote the end of plastics, you know, any way you can. Kneel and kiss the earth your way so that you become an attractor to other people. The more of us that do this together, the better we have a chance of getting through. Get it that politics should not be an adversarial contest between conservatives and progressives, because nature always conserves what works well and changes what doesn't. And Britain tried very briefly this experiment of having both sides at the head of government. It didn't work because no one was trained for it. No one understood what it means to cooperate between the people who change the things that don't work and the people who help us protect the things that do work. Get politics to be non-adversarial and you'll be a big step ahead.
It's a powerful vision, Elizabeth. And
I'm passionate, as you see.
And thank you so much for taking the time and talking today to the Sustainability Agenda and sharing your vision and your passion. And I wish you the very best of success.
And may blessings heap on you for spreading all this good word.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.